welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. Arriving here September the 7th to show part of his new documentary, Apache Line, From Gangs to Hip-Hop, will be hip-hop dancer, choreographer, activist, and historian Jorge Pop Master Fable Pabon, and he will be showing the film at 7 o'clock on September 7th in a free and open to the public viewing in the State Farm Lecture Hall of our Business and Aerospace building here on the campus. And with us on the telephone from New York,
Jorge Fable Pabon.
With us from New York on the telephone, Jorge Fable Pabon. And we're going to talk about his life and his hip-hop history. And then we're going to turn to Dr. Felicia Miyakawa, who is an assistant professor of musicology here at MTSU. And the contact for this little event, you're also going to be speaking to Felicia's hip-hop history and culture class, aren't you?
Yes. Yes, I am. Well, I'd like to thank you for having me on the air first and foremost, and I'm truly excited about going over there and sharing some urban history with the folks over there.
This documentary that you're working on, well, you're working in three at once, but Apache Line in particular that you're working on explores what life was like before it was actually called hip-hop music. Explain a little bit about how street culture and urban life blended into this new art form, which is not actually new anymore. It's more than a quarter of a century old.
Yes, well, actually, when we talk about hip-hop, we are not just speaking about the music. So I definitely want to make that clear. We consider the culture to consist of several different major components. Music is definitely one of them. We also have the dancing aspects and various dance forms that are associated with the culture, as well as the turntablism, which is like what DJs do when they get sort of tricky on the turntables and turn them into musical instruments, and as well as the aerosol art, or what some people call graffiti. So hip-hop actually has always existed let me rephrase that. Each of the components has their own history. For instance, graffiti has been around since forever, actually. In the World War II, you had soldiers who wrote Kilroy was here with a little character, you know. And so that in itself can be considered some form of graffiti, where someone is definitely sort of leaving their mark and letting you know that they were there, which was precisely the same reason why some of the youth did it here in New York and in other parts of the country, like Los Angeles and Chicago and Philadelphia, back in the 60s and 70s. It was just sort of a way to not only just mark your territory, because quite often people would do graffiti outside of their territory, but it was just basically gave them a sense of empowerment. And that's the case with the culture in general, as it ties into gangs and street families. quite often, some of the practitioners of these various components of hip-hop came from these street families, what the media calls gangs or what have you. And it's very complex, the society of especially, you know, what happened here in New York. I'm sure it was very similar in Los Angeles. I've spoken to friends out there that are my age and older, and I find that there was sort of this synergy. It was a really interesting sort of cultural imperative, if you will, where people were expressing themselves in very similar ways. And quite often it happened to be street families, because most of the time urban culture comes from the streets, you know, from a gathering, a block party, a jam, as we call them here in New York. So they were always there, and they were always part of what people eventually called hip-hop. There was a time when the culture really didn't have a title. It was known for its various components, and it was Afrika Bambaataa that basically used the word hip hop, which is a word that was already being used in rhymes, rhyme sequences. Like, for instance, hip hop and shoo wop doo wop. You know, you had MCs who would chant different things.
Back to the doo wop days of the 50s.
Exactly. Which, you know, brings in a whole other point, which is like, really, is how new is hip hop? Hip hop, Lindy hop, bebop, doo wop. I mean, they all actually rhyme. And I'm one that believes that, you know, hip hop really is just, you know, it's the collective sort of vibrations from the past. And it was just sort of recycled by the 70s generation and redone and reapplied in a different way. But quite often it's like looking through a kaleidoscope. The particles in a kaleidoscope are all the same particles. They never add more or take some out. But as you shake the kaleidoscope and look through it again, you have yet another image with the very same components that were in that kaleidoscope. So that's one analogy I'd like to use.
When you're talking about gangs and the gang aspect of it, you're thinking about turf, combativeness, violence. In what respect did hip-hop become a thread that ran through and across gang territory?
It was always part of it. I mean, you know, I don't want to say always. I mean, if to be more specific, what we identify as hip-hop for the generation before me, I would be like maybe second generation. You know, I'm 45 years old. The guys who created hip-hop as we know it are in their 50s. You know, you have Kool Herc, you have Afrika Bambaataa, Grandmaster Flash.
Young hip-hop artists respect the old-school guys?
Do hip-hop artists respect them?
Young hip-hop artists respect the old-school fellas?
Some of them do. Some of them know that without them, they wouldn't be doing it. And others really don't care anyway, you know,
okay. Either
way. So there's all kind of folks out there. Some acknowledge it and some don't. But anyway, coming back to your question, you know, ever since the, you know, early 70s and maybe even late 60s, and even prior to that, you know, when you get into the Jitterbug and what have you, I actually interviewed some gang members from the 50s, and they, you know, in the 50s they were jitterbugging. It was a dance. But they actually called gang activity jitterbugging too. So that's really fascinating.
It's sort of like rock and roll was actually a synonym for sex before it became a synonym for music,
right?
Or music style.
Exactly. So it sort of just, you know, the words tend to take on more than one meaning and sort of help identify the bridge between, or the connection between, the people who are practitioners of the movement, you know, and some of the activities that were done in the movement, which I won't get into the rock and roll part of it, but definitely the jitterbugging. The jitterbugging, you know, in the 50s is the equivalent to, let's say, rocking or up-rocking in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
Which was a war dance that was done and was very popular with gang members here in New York City, where you would mime drawing weapons against each other. Sort of the same concept as capoeira, but physically done a lot different. It looks nothing like capoeira. And capoeira is a Brazilian dance which actually was initially a martial arts form that was created in Angola, Africa, and when the enslaved Africans were brought over to Brazil, some of them were brought over to Brazil, they disguised the martial arts form as a dance because the slave masters obviously wouldn't let them practice a form of self-defense openly.
Well, you are a b-boy and have been a b-boy for a long time, and you have danced in a Lincoln Center production for PBS performances, for Kennedy Center honors events. What kind of reaction do you get when you bring a hip-hop style of dancing and choreography into such highly established, quote-unquote, mainstream venues?
Well, just for the record, I'm not a b-boy. I'm actually a popper. I pop and I lock and I rock. I up rock. A b-boy or a b-girl is someone who does a specific dance, and that is when they get on the floor and do the footwork and do the freezes, etc. So I definitely want to just make sure that people don't mistake me as a b-boy.
Okay.
But regarding these, you know, platforms and venues that we sort of invaded, like, you know, Lincoln Center and Kennedy Center Honors and theater, you know, we also produced the first hip-hop off-Broadway musical called Jam on the Groove. You know, to be honest, at first, we were, I think there was, our audience was sort of mixed and split, you know, where some of them totally appreciated what we did. Some of them were actually our own, of course, people and family, friends that came to support. Others were just more open-minded theater goers that know that, you know, there's power in what we did, and it's a legitimate form of American folklore. Of course, that's the more open-minded traditional theater goers who. And then others were like, you know, just still looked at us as these sort of like street kids. Meanwhile, at that point when we did Lincoln Center and all that, some of us were in our 30s, you know. But still, the stigma, we've been stigmatized the stereotype of like, oh, yeah, these ghetto kids. Mm-hmm. And we actually overheard some people, you know, referring to us as that, like, you know, certain stage directors. Yeah, bring the breakdancing kids out now. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, hey, dude, I'm probably older than you right now.
Are you still as agile as you once were, or have you had to slow down a bit?
No, I think I still get down with intensity, and, you know, there's clips of me on YouTube, and I mean, I'm a little more careful with what I do because of, you know, I'm a little older than I was yesterday.
Yeah.
So I'm careful about especially ground moves, certain ground moves that, you know, require me getting on my knees and stuff like that. I don't want to be confined to a wheelchair, you know, in my 60s or 50s. So I did tone it down a little bit. But I intensified it in my range of movement that I felt secure and safe doing. So yeah, that's basically what I did. I just shifted gears a little bit. But I also wanted to add regarding, you know, when we started performing at these bigger venues, for instance, when we performed at the Kennedy Center Honors, the person who stood up and started and initiated the standing ovation for us. Oh my God, I can't believe I just had his name. Gregory Hines,
the late Gregory Hines.
Gregory Hines was the one who stood up and started applauding, and then got this whole star-studded audience to stand up and follow in suit. And, you know, sometimes someone just has to initiate it and be like, hey, you know, these guys are working hard. This is the new wave in dance, you know, the whole new. Well, not whole new, as I said, we've recycled things from the past, but still, you know, you got to give credit where credit is due. So we've had very established, you know, celebrities give us our props, as we say in the streets, our credit. When we did So What Happens Now, which was the first hip-hop theater production ever back in 1991.
Then it would take somebody with your street cred to be able to do documentaries that you're doing, because otherwise, you know, if someone who has relative lack of familiarity with the subject were to try to do it, they'd either be laughed or chased out of the neighborhood.
Absolutely. There you go. So that's why I'm excited about the project. It's from it's the inside perspective. I grew up around gangs, you know. I don't want to say I was necessarily part of any of these notorious gangs, but I was guilty by association. and quite often I find that people who do documentaries or films regarding this topic, gangs and what have you, are definitely from the outside and quite often get it wrong. You have a whole series on television, Gangland, on the History Channel, I believe, where, you know, it's become like sort of a dime a dozen cookie cutter, same narrative. Well, these guys, these tough and rugged rogue males from, you know, with a narrator who obviously knows nothing about it, and the people who do the interviews are always looking for the same responses, you know. They're not exploring, like, a more human side, a more artistic side, a more celebrative side to these, either gangs or motorcycle clubs or street families. It's always the same, trying to look at it from the same perspective, which I think has definitely gotten really tired. My hopes are that people will look at Apache Line from Gangsta Hip Hop and walk away saying, wow, you know, I may not be that different from these guys, you know. A lot of people tend to sort of stereotype these gang members as like notorious, you know, outlaws who are just out to terrorize the neighborhood and what have you. And little do they know that some of them actually were community advocates and community activists, and political activists and freedom fighters and pioneers in many ways in many different fields. And some of them are extremely charismatic and are, you know, brilliant, actually.
I think that they will probably see that when people watch Apache Line. Let me ask one more thing before I let you go, Fable. You're a native of Spanish Harlem. You're an adjunct professor at New York University. Talk just a little bit about the importance and the necessity to you of chronicling hip-hop culture and music from its earliest origins to the present, the necessity of preserving that knowledge for future generations as music evolves, who might have gained some distance from it, and as current generations are unfamiliar with decades-old music or centuries-old music.
Okay, well, first off, I feel that the urgency and the need to document and archive a lot of this history, number one, because there's a lot of misinformation out there. I think a lot of people are filling in the blanks with conjecture. And so, therefore, you have, you know, this information that will basically mislead people for generations to come. Number two, a lot of the people, you know, we're getting older. We're losing some people. Some people are passing away, you know, dying, and what have you. And if we don't take a minute to ask some of these elders, hip-hop elders, hey, what was it like, you know, in your time? What inspired you to do it, et cetera? Where that piece of history will be lost forever with the person when they pass. There was a time when we did this orally, where oral history was extremely vital to any community and the progress and evolution of any community. In this case, we are living in an age of, you know, digital art, where it's a lot easier to, you know, aim a camera at someone and say, hey, talk to me, and archive it forever, or at least as long as computers are still around and we're still on this earth. So I think it's absolutely vital that this information is passed on. I think that quite often it's very empowering, especially for people that grew up in hard times or grow up in a rough neighborhood, and even for people who don't, so that they can get a better idea of what our struggles are, and not only our struggles but achievements. And when I say our, I mean anyone who might be, you know, trying to obtain voice and power through art. So there's a zillion reasons why I'm doing what I'm doing. Of course, one of them is just my own gratification, because I just really enjoy learning about the past. And although I am an adjunct professor at NYU, and a lot of people refer to me as such, as Professor Fable or what have you, I actually enjoy being a student a lot better, because I feel that that once you feel you know it all, you become sort of the dumbest person in the class.
Well, all good professors are students. All good professors are always scholars. That's, you know, that's part and parcel of it. And I think that's a good segue to go to your fellow artist and scholar, Felicia Miyakawa, here. I don't mean to cut you off. We've barely touched all of your credits. You addressed delegates at the United Nations Hip Hop Conference for Peace in 2001, and on and on and on. But I want to thank you for being with us today, Fable, and I thank you for putting up with the initial technical difficulties that we had in the beginning. If you were here, let's just say we've got bubblegum and baling wire going on here, okay?
That's cool. It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Okay. Jorge, Popmaster Fable Pabon will be here to take questions from the public after the showing of part of his documentary Apache Line, From Gangs to Hip Hop, at 7 p.m. Tuesday, September 7th in the State Farm Lecture Hall. Thanks, Fable.
Thank you.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Felicia, what about talking about the history of hip hop? How do we best chronicle everything that has happened? I mean, I don't know if you actually, there was an article in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution a few years back that characterized it as being 25 years old if you take it back to Grandmaster Flash. You can argue about these things like people arguing in a sports bar about statistics. You know, was the first real rock and roll hit Rocket 88 by Ike Turner? Or was it Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley and his Comets?
Right. Yeah, the Universal Zulu Nation, which is sort of a foundational organization that African Bambaataa put together, they have an actual birth date that they've given hip-hop. And actually, I don't know it off the top of my head. This is horrifying. But it's sometime in November, I think, of a certain year, you know. And so they say, this was the birth of hip-hop. And honestly, I have to admit, I don't know why they chose that day. I think there might have been some sort of gathering that day. And so some people are extremely interested in pinpointing exactly when it started. But as I overheard Fable telling you, each element of hip-hop culture goes back a whole long ways. You know,
right.
Graffiti has its own history, and certainly the dance moves that made their way into b-boying have their own long history that have come from multiple strains. So it depends how you want to define hip-hop. There are cultural ideals, I would say sort of universal ideals that many people who would consider themselves part of hip-hop culture that have been around a long time. You know, some of them go back to very ancient societies on purpose. You know, mm-hmm. this culture was looking for a way to ground itself in the past. So in a way, in simply trying to tell the history of hip-hop, you're establishing the history of hip-hop. It's not necessarily a fact-finding mission. It's a self-proclamation, you know, it's a creation kind of narrative to try and explain how we came to be, almost.
Like the medium is the message, in
exactly.
this case the discipline
exactly.
is the message.
The discipline is the message, yeah. Now, you also have the divide between, you know, we academics who are trying to do it from the distance and, mm-hmm. you know, folks who are actually there from the beginning, and there's still not enough dialogue between the people who have the power to publish, i.e. academics, and the people who are actually there. There's not enough dialogue. That dialogue is increasing.
Well, that's why Fable is an important bridge,
yeah, exactly.
because he transcends both of those
exactly,
worlds,
exactly.
which are literally worlds apart.
Exactly, yeah. Academics, I don't mean to, you know, diss my fellow academics here, but, you know, we have the tendency to be the voice of a thing, of a culture, of a people. And that's not really our job, or at least that's not how I see my job. You know, the people that we talk about can just as well talk for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very valuable thing in hip hop, because those people are still alive in many cases, as Fable
mm-hmm.
was saying. Those elders are still here.
Yeah.
And we are losing some every day. We lose more. So it's important to let them speak for themselves while they still have a chance.
And he corrected me on the difference in the terms of b-boy and pop
yeah.
and break and
yeah.
everything. And I think I went down that road, or my head did, because as someone who's not part of the culture, the mass media have more or less poured all of it into one great big stew and tried to homogenize it, as mass media tried to do.
Sure.
And it's not the best jambalaya is one where you can taste all of the flavors separately, even though they're in the same stew. And I was. You know, to the white-dominated mass media, it's all the same thing.
Sure. And back in the day, in the 80s, those of us who didn't know any better, we called it breakdancing, right?
Right.
Which was a completely incorrect term. I mean, lots of people dance to breaks in songs, but the term that was used was b-boying. But there are so many, even in New York City, in the various boroughs, there are so many individualized styles of dancing that happens within these particular socio-cultural environments, you know.
Right.
And so there's Brooklyn uprocking, and there's, you know, there's b-boying, there's down rock. I mean, there's all sorts of things that I don't claim to be an expert on these dance styles. I have no idea. But I do know that our campus b-boy, b-girl group expressed a little bit of dismay about Fable coming because they said, we just don't have any good music for popping, right? So they at least know the difference. There are you know, beats that you use to dance to when you're breaking, and then there are different kinds of beats that you use when you're popping, and they were a little concerned about that, but we've taken care of that. It's all good.
Is it trite or passe to continue to ask the question, does hip-hop music promote sexism or misogyny, or merely report and violence, or merely report on what's going on in real life?
Yeah, that's it's actually an ongoing, very complex question. One of my former students flagged, I'm not sure if it's an MTV or BET show that's going to be starting on Monday, I think, that's about women MCs, and my cursory glance at the website tells me that it's a very shallow, you know, poppy kind of look at the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
But it's worth talking about. Let's focus first on misogyny and gender issues. Okay, I'm going to be spending a chunk of my course this fall talking about misogyny and gender issues.
Because African-American women artists have spoken out about this kind of thing.
Well, yes, and there's a new wave of feminist hip-hop scholars who have talked specifically about a kind of hip-hop feminism within this broader hip-hop culture. How does a feminist speak out? And there are particular issues involved with black female sexuality in the pop world that, you know, perhaps we don't talk about enough. Given our history, given our cultural history, we need to be talking about this more. So, you know, we'll talk about these things in class, but I'm less interested in saying to the students, you know, A is wrong, B is right, than I am in getting them to recognize that there are deeper roots in everything they see and hear. And to help them see that there have been shifts in hip-hop culture, that what they see right now on videos, if they see videos at all, which just doesn't happen much.
Well, that's,
you know,
antiquated, too.
Exactly. But what they see in hip-hop magazines, what they see online, what any kinds of images, any kinds of sound bites that they consume, this was not the norm in the late 80s, early 90s, let's say. And, you know, there was a time when more conscious, more socially minded lyrics, more pro-woman lyrics, you know, less violent lyrics, that was what was popular at a certain time. And we are in the middle of a phase. And so I think, you know, it's not necessarily a dated question about, you know, hip-hop, misogyny, violence, gender issues. What's worth asking is, when did these shifts happen? Why do they continue to cycle? You know, all of these things are cycles. How do these cycles begin and end? And how do they change when we go through them? What's going on in our broader society that has brought us back to misogyny and violence when we had a period of going away from it?
What about the gay and lesbian community? Are they, gang culture is so macho, are they pariahs in hip-hop culture, or is there an element in which they find acceptance?
No, not much acceptance. There's a really great documentary that came out a couple of years ago by Byron Hurt called Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes, and I'm going to be assigning it to my class. We'll be talking about it and watching it in my class. And he talks about these issues of violence and misogyny and homophobia. And one of the interesting moments in that film is when he points out that there's a whole lot of homoeroticism in hip-hop lyrics and in hip-hop culture that nobody ever wants to talk about, you know. But, you know, 50 Cent half-naked on the cover of a magazine, we're not trying to attract just one kind of viewer there. There's clearly a wide net being cast for potential viewers. And so he sort of puts this homoeroticism up in front of people in the documentary, and it's interesting to see how people react, you know. Most folks are very quick to say, oh, I'm not down with that, I'm not, you know, which sort of reflects majority culture, again. On the other hand, there are some MCs, some DJs, whatever, who are closeted, some who have come out. There's a prominent MC in the Bay Area, and I'm not remembering his name right now. But anyway, he came out very openly about the time when he became well known. And he still remains underground. You know, he hasn't hit the mainstream, which is not necessarily a sign of greatness, in my opinion. But anyway, it's not widely accepted. It is something that we'll talk about in my class as well.
What about the transition of some rap artists to the acting profession, like Ice-T and Ludacris? Do they lose their street cred when they do that?
First of all, not many of them had street cred to begin with. I mean, Ice-T certainly did, you know. Mm-hmm. He was a gangbanger. And you have to remember that in a lot of communities, sports, especially basketball, and music are the two potential ways out, you know. It's not the end in itself to be an artist. It's the means to an end of getting out and staying out of an impoverished community. So if you're using a form of entertainment to get out, turning to acting is just another form of entertaining. You're an entertainer. You're not necessarily an MC, part of a deep entrenched hip-hop culture.
Right.
You are primarily an entertainer. So you're gonna cash in however you can. I don't necessarily seeing it as selling out or anything. I just see it as they're entertainers. They're just broadening their portfolios.
That's another means of expression.
Exactly.
Yeah. What do you want the public audience who is going to be seeing a part of Apache Line on September the 7th to understand about the gang hip hop connection? Mm-hmm. What would you like to what would you like them to get out of it, especially if especially if that culture is a mystery to them?
Absolutely. I want to answer that first with a brief anecdote. Back when I was writing my dissertation many moons ago, one of the questions that I got on a regular basis was, oh, you're writing about hip-hop. Isn't all hip-hop terribly violent? And it became clear to me that people who knew nothing about hip-hop automatically assumed that it was all gangster rap, all violence, all misogynistic, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, folks who are part of it know better. We know that there's a lot of depth and breadth to this music. And to the culture as well. It's the same kind of thing with gangs. We have a very opaque view as outsiders of what that life is. And like all stereotypes, there may be some truths behind them, but there's a whole lot of unknown. And I've been watching the rise in gang activity in Murfreesboro and the attendant sort of political commentary and social commentary about it. I remember getting a political flyer in the mail several months ago, last spring, about, you know, isn't it time to get rid of gangs? And there was graffiti all over it. And I thought, wow, we really need to have a big public discussion about this. And I know just the guy to bring in, you know, to start this discussion. And I'm not trying to say, oh, we've got gangs, therefore we will now have a great hip-hop culture in Murfreesboro. It's not, you know, a one-to-one correlation. But I would like us as a community to have a dialogue about what kinds of positives we can bring out of this situation, what kind of community dialogues. Gangs exist for a particular sociocultural reason. If we don't want them to be in that manifestation, then what can we do in a peaceful way to have this discussion about what's going on in our community?
Not to compare gangs and the mafia, but you might as well ask why the mafia exists. The mafia is a family. Human beings are social, oriented toward being social beings. We need a group. We need a tribe of some kind.
Yeah.
And if it's not the nuclear family, then we'll find one or make one out of whole cloth, out of whatever we happen to have on hand.
Sure, and we're not going to be able to understand folks who choose to be part of the gang life until we try to understand gang life. You know, I mean, we can't just say, hey, why don't you do this? It has to be a two-way dialogue. It has to be a dialogue. So, I mean, I'd like to just get some community conversation going on here. I don't have any expectations in mind where it might lead, but I'd truly love to have some of the community there. Pros and cons, you know, let's have a conversation. And, you know, Fable has seen a lot in his life, and he has talked to so many people, and I think it would be very interesting to have this outside voice in to see what's going on here as well and to join our conversation.
Because the difference between New York City and Murfreesboro, I mean...
Well, there are a few differences, yes.
Yeah, just a few. Yeah. What about the students in your hip-hop and culture class, hip-hop music and culture class? What do you think Fable will bring to the table when he comes?
Well, I am deeply, strongly encouraging all of my students to come to the screening, of course. Unless they have another class, it's pretty much required that they come. But he's also coming to my hip-hop class to talk about Latinos in hip-hop. And I know that is a subject that's very near and dear to him, and something that he's worked on a lot and written about. But I think it's also a story that's worth telling from the perspective of someone who was there, because it's one of those stories that gets erased out of the written versions of hip-hop history. So we sort of know anecdotally in the hip-hop world that there were women there at the beginning, you know, but none of them ever make the history books. And we sort of know that there were Latinos, but this culture gets touted as just an African-American creation. And, you know, that's fine. There is a reason for that brand of storytelling, but it also leaves something out. And historical texts always leave somebody out. And so this is an opportunity for my students to get another side of the story from somebody who was there. So I'm hoping that they'll really relish having an authentic voice there. You know, somebody who was there, somebody who knows, and from a different perspective. And I usually have guests in the class, and very often we'll tell a different story. And that's okay. As far as I'm concerned, that's okay. You know, the students can take many perspectives and think about these differences critically and come up with something.
But again, if you're not from the streets or of the streets, and all you've had is mass media culture,
the
exposure to it, then it's been poured through a sieve, and you're only getting what's left in the colander.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Will you be treated to any of Fable's moves?
Well, he's going to do a popping workshop with the Campus B-Boy B-Girl group. We haven't worked out all of the details of that yet, so I'm not sure what time it is. And I don't know, maybe he'll bust a couple moves in the class. I don't know. You got to watch that guy. He's limber, so he could do anything.
I would love to be there for both the visual and the audio part of that.
Yeah, it'd be great.
It's Tuesday, September the 7th, and it's going to be in the State Farm Lecture Hall of the Business and Aerospace Building, part of the documentary Apache Line from Gangs to Hip Hop, co-produced by Jorge Popmaster Fable Pabon, and put together by Dr. Felicia Miyakawa, who is an associate professor of musicology. I believe I said assistant earlier. I apologize.
No problem.
Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Be sure and join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.